It's about a system that is cannibalizing, eating up its own conditions of possibility. You can't deal with the ecological crisis in abstraction from the crisis of care, from the political crisis and crisis of governance, and from the racial justice crisis that we are facing. These things are tied together. If you want to address the concerns, the interests, the needs of the broad mass of women, you have to get beyond this idea of a single issue gender movement and look at what many people now call intersectionality.
Inside Impact.
Der Podcast mit Wirkung.
Welcome back to Inside Impact. My name is Susan, and this episode is a special issue and a perfect addition to the series on social entrepreneurship meets sustainability. For those of you who are new here, the past 7 episodes were part of a cooperation between the Social Entrepreneurship Center and the Competence Center for Sustainability, Transformation and Responsibility, both here at VU. In this episode, I am honored to have a conversation with Nancy Fraser. Nancy Fraser is professor of philosophy and politics at the New School for Social Research in New York City. During the summer semester, she was the first visiting professor of the International Karl Polanyi Society here at VU Vienna. Why the ecological crisis cannot be addressed without taking into account the underlying capitalist structures and inbuilt relations of inequality in our society is going to be a huge part of this episode. Enjoy! Today, I welcome Nancy Fraser as a guest of our podcast, and I'm very happy that you're here with us today. Hello, Nancy.
Hello, I'm happy to be here.
Thank you. The start that I wanted to make in our talk today is that we, in our previous podcast series that we recorded with other guests, talked a lot about sustainability and the discourse in general that is happening on sustainability. But as we also know from the recent IPCC report that was published, or part of the IPCC report that was published in August, I guess, time to actually act accordingly to save our future from an ecological crisis is getting smaller. Our time is getting used up. So, in your opinion, why are the current efforts to fight global warming insufficient?
Yeah, well, I completely agree that the situation is very dire and that the time to fix it is very short. And I would say that most of the efforts so far have been much too timid, much too unwilling to go after the real drivers of climate change, which I think have to do with the practices of the fossil fuel companies and of all the very powerful business interests that have too much invested in preserving the current system. So when we resort to projects like carbon trading schemes, we're trying to harness capital's own interest in profit to try to solve this problem. But that's a non-starter, because I would say it's capital's interest in profit that brought us to this situation in the first place. And what I mean by that is that the whole capitalist system is based on the profit motive. And that means that the corporations have a deep-seated interest in grabbing as much as they can and as much as they want to use from nature with as cheaply as possible. And in general, they have no obligation in our system to replenish what they take or to repair what they damage. This is not simply a question of the greed of individuals. It's the logic of a social system that creates the incentive to trash nature. It's a system that puts our relation to nature in the hands of mega corporations. Their job is to organize production. That means to extract raw materials, to design an energy system, to design an unsustainable industrial food system, an unsustainable transportation system. Our social system puts them in charge of the quality of soil, the quality of air, the levels of the seas, the character of the climate. They're in charge of all that stuff. And they have every motive to keep trying to milk as much out of nature as they can while putting as little back as they can. So until the regime, the political regime that is supposed to be dealing with and reversing and solving the problem of climate change, until that regime is willing to confront this profit motive that is driving this cannibalization of nature, we won't be able to solve the problem.
Very interesting perspective. And I must admit that I agree with you. You use the term cannibalization now. Can you quickly explain what you're trying to portray with that term?
Yeah. You know, there's a certain irony in this word. Our image is of, you know, dark-skinned natives in primitive societies, roasting, you know, white missionaries and having a feast. But that that standard image actually inverts the real situation. The real situation is the powerful eating the powerless and not the other way around. And what I'm trying to say is that it's not even just about people eating other people. It's about a system that is cannibalizing, eating up its own conditions of possibility. Let me say what I mean. We tend to think of capitalism as an economic system, but that is wrong. That is too narrow. Actually, capitalism is a much larger social system in which the economic subsystem within the society is essentially licensed to eat up the non-economic parts of social life. That means to eat up nature, to eat up unwaged labor of care work and social reproduction, families, communities, and all the activities they do outside the official economy to sustain human beings. It also means the public powers of states and other public agencies that are supposed to solve our problems, but that the economic interests systematically try to weaken as they evade taxes, as they hollow out regulations, as they capture regulatory agencies, as they offshore their operations to escape state powers and state regulations. And it also means the wealth of, let's say, marginalized, peripheralized, usually racialized populations, say in the global South, who don't participate very fully in the official economy, but whose wealth is siphoned through colonialism, dispossession, various forms of imperial extractivism. So what I'm saying is that the official economy rests on its ability to siphon value from these background conditions, from nature, from women's care work, from racialized populations, and from state agencies. It relies on that wealth to fatten its own share prices and profits. It doesn't replenish that wealth. It doesn't repair what it takes from those sources of wealth. And so it cannibalizes its own conditions of possibility. It needs those sources of wealth, yet it depletes them and destabilizes them. The tragedy is that those necessary conditions for the official economy and for the capitalist interests that run the official economy are conditions not only for them, but for us and for the planet. So in cannibalizing their own sources of value, they also cannibalize and threaten to destroy us. And that is fundamentally unacceptable. And that is why I think environmental and ecological movements need to train their focus squarely on the capitalist system and give up the illusions that there can be a green capitalism.
A very interesting point you made. You mentioned that the capitalist system is actually a kind of a threat to us as a society and the planet. And you also mentioned that there is diverse people affected by capitalism. In the global south, they're differently affected than us in the global north. Usually we see climate change isolated from the capitalist system, and that's actually a problem to our understanding also of the situation in which we are currently.
I completely agree with you. And in a recent article that I published, I used a term. I don't know that necessarily I invented this term. I'm not sure where I heard it from or if it's being used by others. But I suggested that our approach to climate change should be trans-environmental. And by that, I mean we have to appreciate that capitalism's tendency to trash nature is inextricably tied together with the other things that I mentioned, with its tendency to guzzle up and deplete the energies for care work, with its tendency to gobble up and deplete the wealth of racialized populations, especially, but not only, in the global South, with its tendency to hollow out public power and, in effect, destroy one of the principal agencies that we might use to solve the problem. You, in other words, you can't deal with the ecological crisis in abstraction from the crisis of care, from the political crisis and crisis of governance, and from the racial justice crisis that we are facing. These things are tied together, and they all have a common matrix, a common source in one and the same social system that underlies all of them. And that is capitalism in the sense that I just explained, not as a simple economic system, but as a system that licenses economic predation or cannibalization of the non-economic zones of life. So I would suggest that the struggle to save the planet, the ecological struggle, cannot proceed in isolation from the struggle to deal with the crisis of social reproduction, from the struggle to deal with the political crisis, from the struggle to deal with the racial justice crisis. These things are linked. And I think that the eco-oriented movements have to widen the lens that they work with and make common cause, try to link up with movements that are primarily focused on those other issues. There's no one right focus when we've got the entanglement of at least four different crises at the same time: ecological, economic, political, social. So we have to develop a way of thinking about the politics of the situation that is aimed at building what I would call a counter-hegemonic block of forces: feminist forces, environmental forces, anti-racist and anti-imperialist forces, democratic forces, and each might have its own location, as you suggested, everybody is situated differently. What appears to you as the primary, most pressing thing might look differently to someone else. It doesn't matter. It's not that there is one right answer. It's that all of these things are interconnected. And so I would suggest an anti-capitalist coalition or block of social movements that can understand that they share a common enemy, even if the emphasis is different here from there. They all have to attack one and the same social system that drives all of these crises.
You also mentioned previously that green growth or green capitalism is actually a real threat to some fundamental change that we might need in order to progress as human beings on this planet. What would you say is the most dangerous part for movements or groups that are actually engaging from this narrative of the possibility of a green capitalism?
Well, I want to say, first of all, that given everything I've already said, it's clear that from my perspective, the very idea of a green capitalism is an illusion. It's a contradiction in terms that capitalism has baked into its very dynamics, its very modus operandi, the idea of constituting a class of people or of interests whose job it is to essentially milk nature for everything it's worth and in the end destroy it. So it's a contradiction in terms. But the danger of it from a political perspective relates to what I was saying just before. I was suggesting the necessity to build a counter-hegemonic bloc that is anti-capitalist, that that's what we need to save the planet and at the same time deal with the other crises that the system is developed that are imbricated with the ecological crisis. Green capitalism is a political strategy that it intends to block the possibility of the kind of anti-capitalist movement that I was just outlining. Green capitalism is a strategy that wants to co-opt powerful segments of the eco and environmental movements into an alliance with supposedly forward-thinking sections of capital. It's an attempt to woo or co-opt strands of environmentalism into what I have elsewhere called progressive neoliberalism. Now, progressive neoliberalism is not new. For 40 years, capitalism has taken a neoliberal turn toward globalization, financialization, offshoring, and ramped up, ratcheted up predation of nature, right? Yeah, taking it to a sharper and sharper pitch. And during this era, it's also a political economy that, as we know, has vastly enriched the 1%, or you could even say the 10%, but especially the 1%, while worsening the life conditions of at least the bottom two-thirds or the 90% of the world's population. And what legitimated that political economy of intensified predation of nature, of care work, of state capacities in much of the world, of racialized peoples, what legitimated that was the idea that this was somehow going to be pro-feminist, anti-racist, pro-LGBTQ plus rights, and now pro-environmental. In other words, this form of neoliberalism, which is progressive neoliberalism, not reactionary neoliberalism, legitimated itself by co-opting liberal strands of all the supposedly emancipatory social movements. From feminism, it took crack the glass ceiling, lean in feminism, the idea that we take some talented tenth of women and allow them to rise to the top of the corporate hierarchy, the political hierarchy, the military hierarchy. This is the feminism of Sheryl Sandberg, of Hillary Clinton, of Christine Lagarde, right? This is a feminism that does not help the 90 or 99% of women on the planet. Now they're trying to do the same thing with the environmental movement and co-opt and basically create an environmentalism for the 1%, or at best the 10%. As you say, this would be an environmentalism that it is not actually going to really reverse the whole energetic basis of the economy. It's not going to defossilize and build a new economic system on renewables, which is what we need to do. It's at best going to cushion the privileged classes in the richer parts of the world from the worst fallout of climate change, or it's going to try to do that. This relates to what you were saying about the different impacts and who is in the areas that are most exposed to toxic dumping, to the wildfires, to floods, and all the lethal impacts of climate change. Green capitalism is a way of continuing this neoliberal predation of nature, which is on steroids today. It's a way of giving that a phony greenwashing, right, legitimation. And basically what I'm suggesting is that that we not fall for that, that we not buy into it, that we try to split off environmentalism from its current alliance with capitalism, or at least those strands of it that are allied with capitalism. And they are powerful. A lot of the older and more well-funded mainstream environmental organizations are part of that progressive neoliberal alliance. My hope is that the radical wing of the environmental movement, which has the interests of the 99% at heart and not just the 1%, can expose green capitalism for the sham that it is and build this other kind of environmental movement and environmentalism for the 99% that links up with feminism for the 99%, anti-racism for the 99%, democracy for the 99%, et cetera, et cetera.
Thank you. And yeah, we touched upon many aspects that are very interesting. So you actually wrote a book 2 years ago with other authors too, which is called Feminism for the 99%. And you also mentioned that there is not only the need of feminism for the 99%, but also environmentalism for the 99%. Can you quickly explain what you mean by for the 99%?
So this little book, Feminism for the 99%, a manifesto, it was co-authored, I need to say first, with Cinzia Arruzza and Tithi Bhattacharya. And our idea was to try to intervene in a situation where it seemed like the mainstream liberal feminism that is always portrayed in the media about, you know, corporate women rising to high office. We sense that with the defeat of Hillary Clinton by Donald Trump in the 2016 U.S. presidential election, that liberal feminism was in a crisis, that people, because interestingly, in that election, more than 50% of white women voted for Trump, not for Hillary. So this already showed that, you know, there was something important going on, that that mainstream feminism was in a kind of crisis. And we wanted to suggest that we were at a, that the movement was at a fork in the road and had two choices. It could either double down with the progressive neoliberalism, with Silicon Valley, Hollywood, Wall Street, which are the sort of forward-looking sectors of the global economy, which were behind Hillary Clinton. We could either double down with that alliance or chart this other path and develop a feminism that was squarely on the side of poor working class and middle class women, not just the professional managerial strata. And that would have to be, in our view, a feminism. And let me use a word that we don't really use in the manifesto, but I think a lot of your listeners will be familiar with. It had to be intersectional. It had to be a feminism that understood that the situation of the 90 or 99% of women, not only in the US, but everywhere, was tied up with questions about class and race and sexuality and ecology, that it couldn't be a single issue feminism movement that was focused only on some allegedly pure idea of gender, which had no race or class or any other component. That by definition could only be a feminism for the 1%. If you want to address the concerns, the interests, the needs of the broad mass of women, you have to get beyond this idea of a single issue gender movement and look at what many people now call intersectionality. For reasons that are somewhat technical and that I won't go into here, although I agree with that as a political idea, I don't use the term intersectionality as a theoretical category. I have a different way of getting at these issues. But that's, as I say, a technical matter. The basic political idea of it is right. And what we said in that book, we said we wanted to break up feminism's or mainstream feminism's co-optation in the progressive neoliberal alliance, build the other feminism. And that meant an anti-capitalist feminism that understood that gender as a deep structure of capitalist society, that understood that capitalism relied on a separation between unwaged care work in family and community life on the one side and paid waged work that contributed to corporate profit making in a direct way on the other side. That's a gendered division between reproduction and production. And in our way of thinking, you can't solve the paradox of women's equality without attacking that deep structure. Now, that is exactly analogous to what I said earlier about ecology, about the capitalist division between inanimate, supposedly inanimate, valueless nature there for the taking on the one side, and human production, which leads to profit and so on and involves human creativity on the other side. That's a similar division, and one that is entrenched at the heart of capitalist society. And we can't deal with the ecological crisis unless we attack that division as well. So I see these two issues, the feminism for the 99% and the environmentalism for the 99%, as deeply connected. They involve some parallels, but not just parallels, actual intersections, because the ecological crisis exacerbates the crisis of care, and vice versa. The ecological crisis worsens the situation of women, and vice versa. So they're completely intertwined. And I would make the same argument from either side, we'd end up at the same place. And the fact that we end up at the same place, whether we start with the gender problematic or with the ecological problematic, or for that matter, with the racial imperial problematic or the democracy, it doesn't matter. We end up at the same place. And in a sense, that's a sort of, dare I say, lucky coincidence, quote unquote, because it means that there's one underlying issue that we can all join forces to try to deal with.
Thank you. Why would you say is it so important that we actually join forces? Would you see it possible if every group of interest tries to actually bring a systematic change forward without being in a kind of cooperation with other groups?
Let's put it this way. The drivers of these various crises, including the ecological, are so deeply entrenched, are so systemic, that the only kind of change that can address them, the problems, resolve these crises, is very deep structural change, a transformation of the social system. No one social movement can possibly be powerful enough to do that on its own. So some kind of coordination, cooperation, alliance is necessary. And that's what I meant by join forces. Now, what form the alliance, the cooperation, coordination takes is another question. I'm not necessarily suggesting, you know, that everyone join one revolutionary party, for example, on the model of Leninism or something like that. There are all sorts of organizational questions about what it means to coordinate and or cooperate. And I firmly believe that that the various movements and even the various factions within each movement, because these movements are not perfectly unified either, that each movement needs a certain level of autonomy. Let's return to feminism for a minute. If we in the feminist movement don't take it upon ourselves to insist at every point on the centrality and relevance of the gender problematic, it can easily get swept under the rug as other movements focus on their primary concerns of ecological devastation or racial, ethnic oppression or whatever. So each movement has to insist that its primary concern be taken very seriously and always be in the mix, always be part of the perspective and the agenda. And so that argues against any kind of full merger that would take away a level of autonomous political action and intervention. So when I say join forces, I'm not suggesting that the sort of dissolution in a homogeneous entity with one single line, like so-called democratic centralism in historic communist parties. I'm not suggesting anything like that at all. And I would frankly admit that I don't think I'm in a position as a social theorist to sort of theorize what the exact form of cooperation must be. Many things are the sorts of things that remain to be invented and worked out in political practice as these struggles proceed. But I do believe that there is a real hunger now among the social movements I've been talking about. There's a real hunger for more coordination, for a kind of a bigger, more encompassing project. One place where we see this hunger in the United States is in the sudden interest, surprising interest, in the word socialism. In the United States, you can actually, in not everywhere, but in some regions and some cities, run for political office and win by calling yourself a socialist. This is a hugely surprising turn of events. We have Bernie Sanders, who calls himself a democratic socialist. We have AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is the sort of charismatic star of left-wing politics at the electoral level in the United States, calling herself a socialist. We have an organization, Democratic Socialists of America, that is hugely growing by leaps and bounds, used to be a tiny nothing, and now has got hordes of young people rushing to join. We have Jacobin Magazine, which is a gigantic success with a huge circulation and many podcasts and journals and a presence in multiple languages across the world, all around the idea of socialism. Now, I don't think that any of these people actually have a fully worked out idea of what they mean by socialism. I think there's still a lot of work to be done for those who want to give that idea a real meaning. But I'm interested in it as a symptom or an expression of the desire for an anti-capitalist project in which all the many social movements that have developed over the last 40 years can find a voice and a place. And that's interesting and important. It's a new step in the sort of political playing field, so that we now see more and more. Again, let's go back to that other word, intersectionality, in the sort of mindset of each of these social movements, including the movement for ecological sustainability. I think this is a very good thing that this intersectional mindset is developing and that people are looking for ways to connect. My own work, as I see it, is about trying to create a sort of a map of what capitalism is and how it works that can help people connect the dots. What I'm doing is not going to cause anyone to become an activist, but I don't need to do that. The state of the terrible state of capitalist society is causing people to become activists. That's happening. What a theorist might be able to do is develop some perspectives that show how to connect the dots. And that's what I think we need now, connecting the dots. And this new salience of the term socialism is an indication of the desire to connect the dots.
That's a very good ending, actually, for our talk, because it also gives our listeners a glimpse on where they can actually start and what they can take of our podcast episode with you. My very last question would be, if you have a book recommendation for our listeners.
Well, gosh, I might have several, but here's one that probably here are two. Can I give you two?
Yes, for sure.
Thinking especially about the ecological problematic, the two most interesting books, and there are so many that I've read in recent times, is the little small book by Andreas Malm on Corona, climate, and I don't remember the title. Maybe you can check it for me. Corona, climate, and crisis, or Corona, climate, and capital, which is about the implication of climate change and of capitalism in the COVID pandemic. And I think that was an extremely well argued. It's a short and accessible book. It's kind of dynamite. The other book I want to recommend is much longer and somewhat more scholarly. It's by John Bellamy Foster, and it's called, just one second. I'm going to get it from my bookshelf. Yeah. It's sitting right here. In fact, I have both of these right here. I now have both these books, and I can give you the correct title of Andreas Malm. It's Corona, Climate, and Chronic Emergency. And this is published by Verso. And let me see. I mean, I think it's 2020. Okay, that's the short, punchy book. The much bigger one is called The Return of Nature, Socialism and Ecology. And this is published by Monthly Review Press in 2020 as well. And what's so interesting about this book is that it excavates and makes visible a forgotten strand of ecological thought and activism, the socialist strand. We tend to think of environmentalism as a sort of freestanding movement disconnected from social justice concerns that has its origin maybe in romanticism, in the conservative romantic critique of industrial society that is polluting nature. And so it starts out as a preservation-oriented movement, an anti-pollution movement. But Bellamy Foster shows us that there was always another strand of environmentalism in which the harm to nature was deeply entwined with class injustice and the harm to human beings. So he writes a lot about Friedrich Engels in the social environmentalism, which horrific toxic conditions in which working class people live in the mid 19th century in England is deeply connected with the trashing of nature. He looks at other important figures in the history of this strand of socialist environmentalism. And this is a historical work, but one that shows us that this idea of trying to build an intersectional form of environmentalism, which would be an environmentalism for the 99%, that we don't have to reinvent the wheel completely, that there is a history of this kind of thinking and that we can still learn a lot from it. So I would highly recommend that.
Thank you very much. Our listeners will find the exact book details, as always, in the description of the episode. And I would thank you very much for this very insightful talk with you. And I wish you all the best.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure. Very enjoyable.
Once again, thank you very much, Nancy, for sharing your perspectives on how to address the ecological crisis without forgetting about the needs of the 99%. If you, our listeners, want to learn more about the feminism for the 99%, we invite you to have a look at our Instagram channel, and please check out the excellent book recommendations by Nancy in this episode's description. Special thanks also go to Professor Andreas Novi and the International Karl Polanyi Society for supporting the creation of this episode. If you want to learn more about the International Karl Polanyi Society and the current visiting professor, Fred Block, you can find more information also in the description of this episode. And stay tuned! The Inside Impact team is already preparing a new series for the upcoming winter month on holacracy and sociocracy. Until then, check out our Instagram channel, InsideImpact_, leave us your thoughts and comments on this episode. And if you want to get in touch with us, you can also send us an email to insideimpact@vu.ac.at. Of course, if you like Inside Impact, feel free to give us a review on your favorite podcast platform and tell your friends about it. See you soon and all the best from the Inside Impact team.